Congressman Mark Meadows.
Thank you. Tonight's evening, I want to start off by saying this. There's obviously a plethora of opinions that are out there. And so as we look at this, probably the biggest thing for me is...
I can't see! Can we turn on the house?
You can't see me?
I can't see the other people in the room. This is the town hall.
Okay. All right. So as we go ahead and get started, here's what I would like to start off by saying. Regardless of your opinion, I want to thank all of you for being kind to my staff. You know, there's one thing when you take out your animosity or your feelings towards me, but it's another when you do it towards my staff. And I just want to say on behalf of all of you that are here, thank you for being kind and courteous to them, and truly for getting here in a respectful manner. Additionally, we're going to get into a number of topics tonight, and ranging from immigration to healthcare to climate to gun rights, you name it. I think we're all over the place. We have a lot of questions. If I don't get to your question tonight, and we're going to try to get to as many, if not all of those that we can, but if we don't get to your question, you will get a personal response from me on those questions that remain unanswered. Additionally, I would like to start this off the way that I think that we ought to start off all public events, and that is with a pledge to our flag. So if you'd please stand with me, please, and pledge allegiance to our flag. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you so much. The sheriff was kind enough to open up, and wherever we go, there are a number of public servants that are out there, and certainly our law enforcement and our first responders, they miss birthdays, anniversaries, a lot of times serving their communities. Would y'all give them a round of applause? With just a few things. We're going to be talking a little bit about health care as the debate gets into health care. There are some who believe that we should have Medicare for all. You made that. There are some who believe that we need to reform the Obamacare system. There are some who believe that we need to repeal and replace it. Two primary goals when it comes to health care. One is that we need to make sure that pre-existing conditions are taken care of, and that's commitment to everybody from day one. The other is we need to lower premiums to make health care affordable again. And all of that has to happen. And so any plan that we have has to do those two things. And that's really why I've been willing to listen very keenly, even to some of my Democrat colleagues, as they have tried to come up with ideas on how we do that. And so tonight, hopefully, we'll share some of that as we look into. I'm sure the questions will be specific as it relates to healthcare. The other is as we look to tax reform and where we are on tax reform and actually putting more money back in your pockets. You know, it's amazing. In Washington, D.C., when we look at Washington, D.C., They spend money, and I believe that they start to teach people how to count billion one, billion two, billion three. We've got to find a way that not only are we responsible fiscally, but that we understand that it's not Washington, D.C.'s money, it's your money. And as we look at that, it's properly allocating that in the correct form. And so we're going to be looking at tax reform and what we do there and trying to bring you up to date on where we are there. Additionally, a lot of you have had a number of questions as it relates to two different areas. One is our military and the funding of our military and where we need to be in terms of readiness and national security. But the other thing that goes alongside that is with our veterans and what we need to make sure that we fulfill our promise to our veterans. That's the other group that I would like to ask you to give a round of applause to. The military and the veterans. If you would stand, if you're a member of the military or a veteran, would you stand? We thank you so much for your service. So as we look into making sure that we provide for those, we also need to go a step further. And in the last couple of days, we've actually been hearing a whole lot about the immigration issue and where it is and what we should be doing. And so I'll be addressing that tonight. If there are no questions there, certainly I'll get into that. I would be surprised if there's no questions there. But those four topics will make sure, or those five topics will make sure that we hit on, even if you haven't asked a question as it relates to that. But I'm going to have Beverly come up, and Kai's going to relieve her later, but we're going to go ahead and start with questions and start asking some questions. And what we'll do is we'll actually go ahead, and when you go to call out that person, if you'll just mention the person's name and we'll let you stand if it's your question. If you want to, if you don't want to, you don't have to, and we'll go ahead and answer some questions.
Will you take follow-ups?
We generally don't take follow-up. If you need a clarifying thing, sometimes the question is very clear, but if I haven't properly answered it and we need a clarifying question, there are times when I allow that to happen. But in general rule, no. As a general rule, we can't have an ongoing conversation back and forth between 400 people. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. The first question is from Philip Price. If you'll stand, please. Yeah. The question is, what health insurance plan do you have now?
Me personally. Okay, what's the other part of the question? He said that's half.
If you were to succeed in repealing the Affordable Care Act, what insurance will you have then, and how would it differ from the Affordable Care?
Okay, thank you for your question. I can tell you that I have currently, members of Congress have Obamacare. I have the Affordable Care Act as one of the priorities. Now, when we look at that, I mean, a lot of people have said, I get this free health care from the government, and that's just not accurate. I mean, I can tell you my premiums are a little over, for my wife and I, a little over $1,000 a month with a $7,500 deductible.
Thank you, Obama.
And so as we look at that, it's all about trying to make sure that we bring those premiums down. So specifically in your question, if we do away with Obamacare, I will be on some other type of program. Now, I can tell you what I had before I went in. I actually had a healthcare sharing program where I actually paid as part of it. Those seem to be actually taking off quite a bit. It was cheaper than what I have now in being on the Affordable Care Act. But I'm one that believes that at this particular point, you know, a lot of people would say, well, golly, can't we do better? Or, you know, you have free health insurance, Congressman, or you have a federal health insurance. And to be sure, many federal employees have a federal health insurance plan. Members of Congress don't, their staffs do not, and so we're actually on Obamacare. What I'm hopeful to see, and I've been in the middle of it, as you well know, really trying to come up with a solution that brings down premiums. Now, when we talk about repeal and replace, actually anything that gets through the Senate will not repeal all of the Affordable Care Act. The tool that's used, you know, a lot of people says, well, why don't you just fix the Affordable Care Act? Well, actually, part of what we were looking to do was to just fix part of the Affordable Care Act. But hear me out, as we look at that, the Affordable Care Act has some 12 mandates, and many of what I was talking about is trying to adjust four of those 12 Obamacare mandates. And so even with the most aggressive plan that was put forth out of the House and considered in the Senate, it was leaving much of Obamacare in place. It was getting rid of the individual mandates, the employer mandates, and some of those things. And so what we end up with, hopefully, in fact, what will get my vote, is something that will lower premiums and allow those pre-existing conditions to be taken care of. The most talked about thing in the last 2 weeks has actually been a proposal that Lindsey Graham has been working on, and that is more with block granting Medicaid and Obamacare subsidies. We'll get into that later. We'll get into whatever you want to talk about. And listen, guys, all I'm wanting to do is tell you what's being talked about. At that particular point, we'll be glad to do it, and I'm sure there will be another question as it relates to Medicare for All. But as we look at that, that is a good question. Thank you.
The second part of the question is the most important of what I was interested in, because I knew the answer to the first question. Do you not fall back on the federal program?
I do not. I don't fall back on the federal program. I guess technically I could have exempted myself and said that I exempt myself and that I could have been on a federal plan, but that's not the case with me. I felt like if I was going to have one standard that applied to all of you, that the same standard needed to apply to me. And that's, so I can tell you that I didn't end up back on a federal health benefits plan unless something gets enacted very differently. And like I said, when we look at repealing, it's going to leave much of the Affordable Care Act in place, which would actually still be something that applied to me. Great question. All right.
The next question is from Barbara Rogers of Leicester. This also is on health care.
Lester. We can tell she wasn't from there.
What is your plan to move to a more free market, patient-centered model while addressing the special needs of those with pre-existing conditions?
All right, thank you. Thank you for your question. So here's one of the things that we are trying to look at, is there are some people who love Obamacare, want to keep Obamacare, and so you may have some good news tonight. And so as we were looking at that, we said, well, what could we do to perhaps create a free market solution alongside of the Obamacare market? And right now there's about 9.3 million people on the Obamacare exchanges. Of that, about half of those are what you would say they get the subsidy, the other half does not. And so if we could create a free market that would allow you or anybody to go out and buy a insurance policy that meets your needs, that doesn't have to have a certain standard. For example, I mean, as we look at this, you know, it's all about making sure that you have the choices that best fit you. I can tell you that from my standpoint, there are certain aspects of the coverage that I have to cover that we'll never be able to use or benefit from. And so I'm paying for some types of coverage that I would not be there. So part of what we look at is that it's called insurance. You have an insurable risk, and as you have that insurable risk, you take out the insurance to cover those insurable risks. And so as we look at that, probably the biggest thing that I would see is giving that flexibility in the free market where people aren't having to make a choice between their insurance payments and their mortgage payments. And right now, when you look at it, that's happening quite often, more often than it has. And I'm not saying that that's just a problem with Obamacare. I'm saying that that is a problem across the board because we haven't hit the fundamental problem of lowering healthcare costs. And we got to do that. And so we've been working with what they call the Freedom Choice Amendment to actually give that. That's one option that we have there. There's another that we're actually working on right now to allow association plans. So let's say that if you're a real estate person here and you're part of the Board of Realtors, right now it's illegal for the Board of Realtors to be able to offer that insurance to all of their members. But yet they could actually provide a policy that maybe is as cheap as an employer plan if we allow them to bundle it together. So it's allowing them to compete in the market, again, giving more choices, but it's a great question and hopefully we'll get there. Thanks.
Okay, the next question is from Leslie Wingard. What are your plans for providing health care for the citizens of Western North Carolina should the Affordable Care Act be repealed?
All right, so it's a reoccurring theme. I bet we have a lot of these, but at the end of this, we'll probably have talked about every particular option. So here's the two schools of thought. And one that obviously got a cheer earlier was Medicare for All. Another option that is out there is looking at some of the more free market things that we were just talking about. There are two other options that are out there as well. And those other options are allowing for more association plans to be able to provide their own risk pool. So, you know, if you're there. Then there's a third option. There is a third option that's out there, or a fourth option, I guess that would be, is where we look at actually increasing some of the funds that are there and block granting those to the state. So then that way, North Carolina. Now, I find that interesting because many of you who want Medicare for All want the government to tell you what you're going to charge and not charge, and yet you don't want the state to do that. I don't understand that, but that's all right. I'm sure I'll get that a little bit better understanding. And so I guess here's where I come with. The block grant, here's what it would do. It would actually, for North Carolina, would actually increase the amount of money that goes to Medicaid. It actually would actually augment that because we're not an expansion state. And so some of the states that were in expansion, some of the states expanded, and 19 did not. And so as we look at that, one of the things that we can look is at the expansion part of that. And so it would actually provide additional monies there. Then in addition to that, it would take the subsidies that are out there for the Affordable Care Act and block grant those to the states as well. Now what that would do is actually allow for the state to develop plans that are designed to actually be what North Carolina, the 9 million plus people, would be. And so I've talked to not only the insurance commissioners, but I've talked to those in our state legislature. Now this is a Republican who's saying that this we're wanting to do this with a Democrat governor, guys. I mean, y'all talk about it. So
1.3 million people lose coverage in North Carolina.
All right, so as we start to look at these numbers, yes.
Folks, please, we want to hear everybody. This gentleman is taking his time and he's trying to tell you the answers to the question. So I'm asking you to please let him finish his question. Thank you.
All right, so let me suggest that all of those plans are potential plans that are out there. Each one of them really with the sole focus of trying to lower healthcare premiums. Now, when we look at that in terms of designing that, there are a number of things that potentially would make the block grant not work, is if you take all of that money and you just move it to the states and you leave the Obamacare or the ACA regulations in place, you're just shifting one person who's paying it to another. I don't know that that actually accomplishes anything that any of you in here want, because it doesn't actually lower coverage, the cost of coverage. And so as we look at that, that's a critical component. But those are all the ones that we're discussing right now. As I see that, the ones that are picking up the most steam would be the block grant option, and perhaps the ones that allow the association plans to actually allow the private market to compete alongside of Obamacare. Now, each one of them has its inherent advantages and disadvantages. And so as we look at that, that's why our primary purpose has to be, it has to be lowering healthcare costs, along with that, the premiums, and handling pre-existing conditions. You know, I have made a pledge not only to all of you, but I've made a pledge on national TV. I've made a pledge over and over again to not support anything that doesn't lower premiums and cover pre-existing conditions. Those are the two things that have to happen. So where we go with that, I think probably the biggest thing is the debate that is ongoing and that is actually happening each and every day continues to happen. Even earlier today, is how we go about doing that in the best way that we can.
Okay, this next question is in regard to the premium costs. It's from Terry Miller. Please elaborate on the freedoms your caucus supports and for whom they support.
Okay. Many of you know that actually I'm the chairman of the Freedom Caucus, which thank you for your with two things in mind. One is to make sure that we gave a voice to really the forgotten man or woman. So as we look at that, one of the things that we put forward was that to be a member of the Freedom Caucus, you had to be able to follow two rules. One is that you had to be willing to vote with your own party or your leadership and your party leadership. But you also had to vote against your own party leadership. You had to be willing to do both of those, because so many times what happens is people go up and they say that we're going to be supportive of this and that, and they just follow along party lines. And so I'll give you a prime example of this. I'll give you a prime example of this. And not to open up a Pandora's box, because we have different opinions here without a doubt. But when it came to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, many in my party wanted us to engage in that and be supportive of that. I found myself at that particular point really just getting all kinds of input from across the district. And the overwhelming support at that particular time was to not support that. And that was a difficult position to be, because most of my party was pushing that. In fact, the current speaker was pushing that very hard. And yet we took on a position to not support that and to be able to vote with our constituency and do that. So that's a prime example of where you have to do that. Those freedoms, it's really, they're enshrined in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And those are the freedoms that we have to protect. It's part of the reason why I'm here tonight. It's all about free speech and making, you can have a different opinion from me, but I will defend every day your right to have that opinion. Okay? Thank you for the question.
Is in regard to term limits. Trish Chambers, would you stand, please?
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Trish, get that done. In fact, I was talking to somebody earlier today about term limits. He says, if you would just attach it to something, and I'm willing to attach it to something that's a must-pass piece of the legislation, says that you get it in a place where there's actually term limits, actually enacted in the law. There is not, Trish, there's not really the support even on either side. I mean, on either side for term limits. So maybe what you have to do in order to get it in is you grandfather those people that are in, and allow it to come kick in later? I don't know. I'm just saying that you can't find 218 Democrats or Republicans to support that. Now, the Convention of the States, my position has actually changed on that. I originally was probably against the Convention of the States, and so as we look at that, it's all about trying to make sure that Congress works for the men and women here. And when we can't get things done, that's more obvious, and it happens more often than it should. We've got to find a way to get things done, and hopefully we can do that. But thank you for your question.
Okay, this next question goes back to health care. And it's from Diane Swift. When are you and the rest of Congress going to start listening to the majority of the people who do not want their health care taken away and who want to keep Medicaid and Medicare and the Social Security social safety nets?
Thank you for your question. So as we look at this, let's go over a few numbers. There's 176 million people that have employer-based health coverage, which has nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act other than tweaking a few rules and regulations. So 176 million people of the 318 million people that are here.
Until they lose their jobs.
Really, really there. And if they lose their jobs, generally speaking, they go back to work for another employer if they're 317% of the poverty or greater, or they become eligible for other safety net programs. And so here's the thing is I've been one that's been very steadfast in making sure that we have a safety net for those that need it. Because here's at 350% of poverty, what we look at is having some type of assistance. The bill that we passed out of the House actually had subsidies up to a much higher amount, and actually I felt like it was too generous above 400% of poverty. In fact, was helping those that perhaps can take on the responsibility themselves. I got with Senator Thune over in the Senate side and looked at taking that same amount of money and pushing that down into those that need more of the safety net. And that's why you saw what was attempting to get out of the Senate was at 350% of the poverty level in terms of subsidies. That being said, we have to figure a way that we provide a real safety net for those that need it, and yet at the same time that we don't take the value of work away from anybody. You know, here's the interesting thing is we've come to a point where we applaud success, we hate successful people. But yet at the same time, we have to make sure that what we do is that we help those who truly need a helping hand, but not create a situation where we're taking some. Again, I'll start the way I started this. It's not DC's money. It's the American taxpayers' money. And we have to make sure that we're a good steward of that. And if we're a good steward of that, we're making sure that we do that. Now, some have suggested, and let's have a real discussion about Medicare for All. Because let's go ahead and let's talk about that. Because one of the things that I do is I actually read the bills before I vote on them. Yeah. I mean, you know, I know it's a bad but when you read the bills, you start to look at a number of things. And when you look at some of the proposals that are out there, and I'm not saying every one, but when you look at some of the proposals that are out there in terms of Medicare for All, the price tag is just unbelievably high. Now, and so you can look at, and some of you were Bernie Sanders supporters, and so that's where this came from, and you look at that, but even with Bernie's numbers, I can tell you that the cost associated with that is about half of what it really will be. It's 30, you know, we're looking at trillions of dollars, not billions of dollars. And so when we're starting to see that, it has to be a tax
on the rich.
Figure a way to tax the rich at 100% and pay for it. I'm just telling you, the numbers.
You're lying. You don't believe that.
I promise you that you can tax. Hold on. Here, I can tell you, is you can take the top 1% and you can tax them fully and it still won't pay for it.
That's right.
All right, let me just say this. If you guys disagree, here's what I would ask you, is send me the information.
I have.
And I've reviewed it if you've sent it to me. We had 29,992 emails or letters in the first 6 months or 7 months of this year. And so I can tell you that we're going to go ahead and address this. But if you've got a way to pay for Medicare for All, that will tackle one of the problems. Here's the other problem with Medicare for All. Here's one of the other problems with Medicare for All. How many of you are familiar with all the problems we've had with the VA? How many of you are familiar with that? All right, the rest of you, perhaps not. When you look at government intervention in healthcare as a provider, it is not necessarily the most efficient or the best way to do that. Even with TRICARE, even when you look at TRICARE, and listen, I talk to my veterans on a daily basis with TRICARE, and so as we look at that, even with that, when you see that, there are things in terms of the efficiency of the deployment of those dollars that don't work. Now, when we all talk about it, there's nothing we take more personally than our health. And as we look at that, and 1/5 of the economy now is being spent on healthcare. So we have to get this right. I'm willing to look at even things that I would never in a million years be willing to look at, but I want to say this. I need the facts and figures to back it up, and some of you apparently have those, and so I'd be glad to do that.
Canada.
This next question was from This next question is from Luis Glickman in Candler. What do tax cuts have to do with health care?
All right. So what do tax cuts have to do with health care? One of the block grant issues that we're looking at, was it Luis? Was your first name? So one of the things that we're looking at there, when the Affordable Care Act came in, it came in with all kinds of taxes to pay for it. I mean, it was not just one tax, it was multiple taxes that came in to pay for it because of the expense of it. And even with bringing people in and making a mandate that says that you have to have coverage, there were taxes that came in alongside of that. There have been two different things that have looked at. Is you repeal the Affordable Care Act, you repeal the taxes that came in with it, you start over, you get something else, and then you come in with new taxes, a whole new regulatory scheme to be able to do that. The other thing, and just to be frank, on the one with Lindsey Graham, is looking at keeping a lot of those taxes in place to pay for the block grant portion that goes to the state. Many of us are looking at a variety. Nothing is off the table. We're trying to look at how we solve this, but I can tell you that the tax component was tied in with the Affordable Care Act when it passed. One of the reasons, it's an arcane budget rule, but one of the reasons why they were wanting to do health care before tax reform is that if you repealed those taxes, it allowed for a much more aggressive tax cut for the middle class. In terms of the baseline for budgeting, because what happens is you have to make up the gap. Anytime you cut taxes, you're making up the gap from where the taxes are versus where you're cutting them to. So lowering those taxes would make that gap lower, and that may be getting wonky there, but that was part of the reason to do it. Even right now, though, they're looking at tax reform without doing the Affordable Care Act as a prerequisite. So you have a follow-up? Well, if it's clarifying the question, I can't ask 400 follow-up questions, but just to clarify, and so if I misunderstood your question, go ahead.
And that this is not just about insurance, it's about also addressing cost.
Right. And so I don't know that, and so maybe I misunderstood a little bit of the question on the tax side of it, but I get your point on the cost containment. And so one of the things that I've been looking at very closely is how do we take prescription drug prices and get them down in terms of a reasonable price. And so it's something that I actually, it's something that, you know, I get Democrat colleagues to come on board with as we look at that. You know, there's two different functions on how you do the cost containment. But the other part of that is part of the reason why we have these unbelievable different schedules that we have right now on healthcare is because that we have Medicare and we have Medicaid that comes in, we have private insurance, we have you know, more charitable coverage as well. And so you have all of those different mixes. And so you can come in, you and I can come in, and you could be, you know, a private insurance. I can come in on Medicare. I will get charged something very different at the hospital or at the doctor's office, you know, based on the type of coverage. So one of the things I believe is that we ought to have transparency. We negotiate more over a head of lettuce than we do over a real procedure. You know, and so if you're going to go in, we need to have transparency. And what that means is that you end up with your insurance companies that will not necessarily like that because they know to negotiate a different deal with every provider. And that's why sometimes when you ask your doctor, you say, well, I would just rather pay cash for this. I know that doesn't happen often, but if you would rather pay cash for them, sometimes they don't know what to charge you because they don't know what they're going to get reimbursed from the insurance company. We need to do a better job of that. And I think those are one of those reforms that we can find Democrats and Republicans to come together on.
This next question is from Carol Plotch in Waynesville. She says, will you work with Democrats to reform healthcare? If no, why not? And if yes, how and when will you reach across the aisle?
Okay, she stood up. It was your lookalike over here, I guess. All right. So thank you for the question. I'll answer it in three different ways. One is answer it completely. So the real discouraging part was when we started in on this, Chuck Schumer said he wasn't going to help with anything. Now, you may not like that, but you can go Google it right now. You can see that he said he wasn't going to help with anything. Now, when you have that, then you know that it is really going to be Republican-driven to do that. Now, even inside of that, I'm going to answer the question. I promise I'll answer the question. All right? Cool. Even in spite of that, I went to five of my Democrat colleagues. I said, I understand that politically you can't repeal something that has a president that you supported in the last administration. I get that. I understand the political. But what I would like to do is to get your input. And I went to five different Democrats, not just from North Carolina, but all over the country. And said, you know, what are the most important things that we could actually address? Now, we are finding some kind of agreement with some of our Democrat colleagues as it relates to the individual mandate, the employer mandate. We're seeing some of that. But we asked for real input. Some of that real input actually got put in the House bill that came out. And it was all about making sure that not only pre-existing conditions got covered, but what they call guarantee issue, which says that you had to issue it. That stayed in. That was a direct result of some input from some of my Democrat colleagues. So the final thing is, so the final thing that I will go ahead and talk about is this. I think at this particular point, when we look at working with Democrats, I had a conversation, and I'm always reluctant to mention Democrats' names in a public forum, but I will tonight, because I don't want, in their district, if they see the Freedom Caucus chairman saying that they're working with them, it's not normally a good thing. And so I had a long conversation with Elijah Cummings just last Friday as it relates to prescription drugs, and we had a conversation there. I've had a number of conversations with Jerry Conley as well out of Virginia. Both of those, I happen to have a relationship with them because I serve on a committee with them. And we've built a level of trust in a bipartisan way. And so you hopefully will see some of that. Actually, some of what we're working on is actually trying to work together on with regards to the opioid epidemic and how we address that as well. But thank you for your question. I will do my best. I will.
This next question is from Patricia Danz in Flat Rock. She says, is there any hope that we will get a decent health care plan this year?
Well, there is. I believe at this point we've reached a critical point. For those of you that wanted to repeal Obamacare, you don't understand why there wasn't something on President Trump's desk on January 20th. I get that. You know, and for those of you that want to keep it, you're glad that there wasn't. I get that as well. And so here's where I see the play and what I believe is going to happen. There's going to be a whole lot of work that happens this week and next week, even while we're, quote, in recess, working to try to come up with a bill that actually gets marked up when we go back in September. It will come from the Senate first. I think they have to show that they can get to either 51 or 60 votes, depending on what it happens. And so as we look at that, I fully anticipate a vote very early in September and ultimately a bill that gets sent to the president by the end of September. The longer that takes, the more unlikely it is that something will get signed into law that it goes beyond there. There is a number of us that are looking at other vehicles that actually gives the kind of flexibility on the private sector side of things, but yet also provides some stability in the Obamacare markets. And that is one of those areas that we're trying to look at. We don't want a decision in Washington, D.C. to create a crisis for anybody on healthcare. Now, I know that many times what happens, let me just say this. I mean, you can disagree with it. You can disagree with that statement, but I can tell you that's not the intent, nor is it what we want to do. And so in doing that, it requires us to really work very diligently to look at all the facts and figures to make sure that we get it right. For me, I find that a free market approach actually has the best way of bringing down costs. NCI, Sprint, all the other long-distance carriers. How many of you remember that? Now, come on. I look out. We've got. What happened was we took a regulated monopoly and we broke it up. We said there's going to be competition. So what happened was two things actually came out of that. Long-distance rates went from $1.05 a minute down to less than 5 cents a minute. I don't know if you remember, but I had to wait many times until after 11 o'clock when the rates went down. How many of you? All right, so if you remember that, what happened was, I also remember that we had a party line. And I tell people in Washington, D.C. what a party line is, and they say, there's absolutely no way that you have. And I said, no, you would pick up if somebody was on the line. They were actually sharing the line with you. It was a party line, and I shared it. So what happened was, is we took and we deregulated that, and we got also the amount of long distance charges per minute drastically dope. The other thing that happened was, is we got technology to come in. So instead of just being tied to landlines, all of a sudden to make up for that market, we started seeing the advent of cell phones. Now the first cell phone that I got was a bag phone. I was only going to use it in emergencies. It had a little thing that I would put it up on the, but now we carry them around. If you don't have a cell phone, you know, many of you got rid of your landlines. Now that's what the free market can do many times when we look at costs and actually doing that. All right.
question. This next question is from Lorna Barnett from Halloween. She says, "We know that every modern nation but the United States has health care for all. Why do you believe that Americans don't deserve health care or that we aren't capable of achieving it?"
Well, I believe that we do deserve health care. Thank you for your question. I do agree that we deserve health care, and it's also one of the reasons why a lot of those... Listen, there's a federal law right now that says everybody has to be covered. I mean, it's been on the books for years. And so when we look at that, if you really look at that, you know, you can Google Ted Kennedy. You can go through and Google it. It is a federal law right now. And so as we look at that, when we talk about health care for all, here's the other thing that we look at, is that when you look at some of these other countries, they're coming to our country for our doctors. Some of you agree with that very loudly, so that's why we had that. But as we look at that, one of the issues that we have is that when you make the assumption, that actually that the government can provide something better than the free market, you're making a fundamental decision that typically is not proved out. How many of you, so let me take Medicare, since my mom says whatever I do, I can't touch Medicare. I heard Medicare mentioned, so let me go ahead and mention Medicare. There are, even in Medicare, there are drugs and other things that you cannot do even under your Medicare policy. You guys have experienced that. And so at some point, when you're looking at $32 trillion over a 10-year period, It adds up to real money. And so what I'm here to say is that I wouldn't exchange my health care that I have in the United States for any country abroad. And if you would, God bless you, because I can tell you, there was somebody just recently that they wouldn't even let come and get a procedure here in the parents'
house. Baby dad!
Question is from John Reed in Silva. He says, "Can you cite examples where you have worked across the aisle with Democrats or co-sponsored legislation with Democrats?"
Yeah, and so let me follow up with that. The question, obviously, I mentioned Elijah Cumming. I think if he had a primary opponent, he could probably be able to sustain that in Baltimore. But Elijah is one. Jerry Conley is another. We've worked very closely on what we call not only a transparency aspect, but also making sure that what happens is that the federal agencies properly spend IT dollars. And so when we look at that, he's actually one of the sponsors of the Data Act, and he's doing the Data Act 2.0. He's leading that. I'm co-sponsoring that with him. We spend in the federal government about $80 billion a year on IT, and yet we get very, very limited, and that doesn't include CIA, NSA, you know, where there's another $20 billion that's spent. So $80 billion across the federal government, and so he's really looking to streamline that and do that. We're working together on procurement to make sure that procurement is one that actually goes to the best bid and the one that's a low-cost provider and not some well-connected big company. I've met major resistance when I do that, but it's all about trying to be a good steward of the taxpayer dollar. Additionally, I can tell you here in the state, G.K. Butterfield, I'm the one that he's a Democrat. He will come to me many times to co-sponsor things. We disagree on a lot of fundamentally, maybe ideologically, be way far apart. I haven't looked at the numbers in the last year or so, but I can tell you that the previous Congress, I had co-sponsored more Democrat-led legislation than any member of the North Carolina delegation other than Walter Jones. And so, you know, we're looking for opportunities to provide a bipartisan solution. You know, for me, I'm a business guy, and getting results is what it's all about. And if I can find a Democrat that's willing to lead on something, I'm all for it. And I would encourage you to challenge me. You have a follow-up. I don't know how that question could have been any more clear. So we won't do your follow-up. I think you're very clear on that, okay?
This next question is from Joe Robustelli in Hendersonville. He says, what have you done to help the economy in Western North Carolina?
So there's really three things that we've tried to work on in working with our manufacturers. One is from a standpoint of outreach on the commerce side of things. I can tell you that we've worked with the previous Secretary of Commerce, also working with this current administration at the state level, to make sure that what happens is that we actually are ready and open and willing for business. Now, part of that is the federal role, is making sure that the federal regulations get out of the way and allow us to actually put people to work here in the district. I met personally with a number of CEOs who have come to try to make a decision on whether to locate here to Western North Carolina or not. I mean, if they're all about putting jobs here, we'll drop what we have and we'll actually work with them on that. Then going even above and beyond that is trying to make sure that we have a good infrastructure that actually supports that. One of the biggest things is not just the roads, but it's the broadband, the high-speed internet. When I tell people up in Washington, D.C., that my house or many of our houses in the district do not have high speed, you know, that I had dial-up, you had to hold your head this way and hope that, you know, the circle would load fast enough to do that. It's all about doing that. So I've worked with some of our carriers to make sure that they're not just taking the fillet of getting the big metropolitan areas like Asheville or Charlotte or Raleigh, but they're also serving the rural community. So we've been trying to work very closely with them, actually working also with the Appalachian Regional Commission, which actually has been a partner in some of those. So from a job creation standpoint, we've been real involved in doing that. Now I'd say two things. There's one other thing. We also have over 1,000 good paying jobs that we can fill tomorrow. And it is very, very concerning to me that we have over 1,000 jobs that literally, if you could pass a drug test and show up to work, you get employed. Now, when I say that, this is talking from, and you may disagree, but send them to me. If you've got somebody that meets those two qualifications, I can get them a job within a week. And so in doing that, these are paying jobs that are $15 an hour or higher. And so I would say that when we do that, we need to make sure that we have a workforce that's ready to go as well. And so we've been working with many of our vocational schools and community colleges to make sure that we do that in trying to do that. But thanks for the question.
Okay, this next question is from Rick Toner. This is back to healthcare.
I'm not going to wrestle you, though, I can tell you that.
And where in the Constitution does it allow any federal healthcare?
Yeah.
Well, obviously in the Constitution, it doesn't allow for that. And so as we look at that, you know, really when we start debating many of these things, here's where we have to understand. Is I've got a lot of my libertarian friends who say that we shouldn't have anything to do with health care. We ought to be out of it. Now, the reality is we're in health care because of Medicaid and Medicare, and I don't see those going away in any shape, form, or fashion. And so is there a constitutional role in one of those enumerated powers? Not that I've read. That being said, obviously, the General Welfare Clause is a very different clause for a different reason, but we can talk about that as well if there's a question in there. But as we look at this, one of the things we've got to do is figure out where we go and again in addressing that based on the circumstances where we are. But I appreciate your question. It's not there. So you have a real quick follow-up. It does. It does say bring it back to the states. It's a state's role. That's part of what we're looking at with this block grant is to give it more of the states the ability to design.
comes. When do you believe we will see the Affordable Care Act repealed?
All right, I've already answered that one. I'll be real quick. I think if we don't have a bill in September, it's probably not going to happen, but that's where we are. Thanks.
This next question is from Juliana Morton. Why can't the GOP do a better job of messaging that the GOP is helping women and children and families?
Because they are.
So you disagree with that one? You don't want us to have a better message. Okay, all right. Well, that's an honest Democrat. That's good. I mean, I appreciate it. So as we do that, here's one of the interesting things is I have looked in terms of the people who come and visit me, whether it's here in our local office or in Washington, D.C. We have basically our parameters are if you come and you're advocating, I don't care what you're advocating on behalf of, if you come and advocate on behalf of it and you're a constituent, you get in first. If you're from the state, you get in next. And some of you who know that you have a different opinion than I have, know that I am good to my word there, that no matter what you're advocating on behalf, we have discussions. And actually, some of the discussions, as it relates to climate, there hadn't been a climate question yet, but has been interesting I had some people coming up and they wanted me to look at some stuff, and so we're actually I'm looking at the people that I'm actually doing that with. I didn't even see you there. But we're actually going to go ahead and do that. And I had one of the most delightful conversations with someone in a respectful way. And I'll say that now that I can see you face to face, where they actually presented some facts, and I wanted to actually take part in getting to understand those facts. And so for me, it's all about making sure that you do that. And so if you come up and you're from the district, please, if you're advocating on anything, let them know that you're coming from the district, because lobbyists are third on the list. They're the last on the list. And so we want to make sure that that happens. But thank you. You know, let me say this, and I don't know who you are, but if you have called my office,
and you
have gotten, well, so are you saying that you didn't get to talk to a real person? Hold on, because I'm. Are you saying that you never talked to a real person? Because if you'll give me your address and all that, we'll go back and check it. Okay. So let me just say this. Yeah. So let me just say this. We have seven staffers in Washington, D.C. During the month of March, I got over 17,000 phone calls. 17,000. Now, I can tell you on a variety of issues. So here's the thing is, statistically, what we do is I keep track of every single call, what they called on, whether they're for or against it. And I can tell you that we take good traction in terms of trying to understand that. Now, at the same time, what I want to make sure of is that if you send something to us, we track it. Like I said, over 29,000 emails and letters that have come in up until July of this year. And so getting information to me is not something that doesn't happen. And in fact, we pride ourselves on doing that. Our staff actually keeps track and logs everything. And so I would disagree with you in terms of who you can call. But if you want to write down your name and number, we'll be glad to give the statistics to you. Thanks.
Okay, this next question is from Dr. John Richard. What is your rationale for supporting gun laws that police officers oppose?
I don't know what gun laws that I've supported that law enforcement officers have not. And so I can tell you I'm a strong Second Amendment rights guy. I believe it's really important. I can tell you this. within 10 days of me actually going up to Washington, D.C. as a freshman, there was more gun-related violence in the 10 days that has some of the strictest gun laws
That's right.
in the country than the last 10 years in the home county that I was from.
Right.
Now, when we look at that, you know, do we have to deal with some of the mental health issues and that we're looking at? Yes. But I can tell you that when we look at, just like I'm going to defend your First Amendment rights, I'm going to defend your Second Amendment rights,
yeah.
your Fourth Amendment rights, Woo! Your Fifth Amendment rights. And so I'm not at odds. I don't know that I'm at odds with any of our law enforcement. But I've got extremely close relationship with all our law enforcement. So you have a clarifying question or comment? Yeah. Well, you know, actually, if you look at it, I can tell you, if you want somebody who doesn't support the Second Amendment, you probably want a different member of Congress, because I'm not going to yield to that. I can tell you this. So when we look at that, when you look at Washington, D.C., and you look at Heller, that Heller decision in Washington, D.C., was a decision that may illuminate, your particular position a little bit more in the expansiveness of that Second Amendment right.
Okay, this next question is in regard to EMP, electromagnetic pulse bombs or attacks. It's from Glenn Ingram. What is the Congress doing to hardwire our electrical grid to defeat an EMP attack, and are you willing to lead that effort?
Thank you, Glenn. This is something that does receive bipartisan support most of the time, is protecting our grid. And if you look at electromagnetic pulses, really when you look at the effect that it could have, not only on our grid, but on everything that you have that has a chip. I mean, you really are looking at a potential national security issue. I can tell you that I raised this early on, Glenn, and much of the feedback that I got at the federal level is, it wasn't an issue. They kept saying, well, it's not an issue. We haven't let that drop, because I continue to hear from both Democrats, unaffiliated, and Republicans that it's a real concern and should be as a national security. And so we are trying to lead the charge in transportation and infrastructure, because it actually comes under one of our committees. And so we're leading it there. In addition to that is looking at the protections in space. One of the things that many times we ignore is the whole space frontier and what's happening. You know, there was a time when the Russians actually beat us into space. Some of you are old enough to remember that. Many of you are probably not. And so as we look at that, we're losing the battle in space again. And not to the Russians, but actually to the Chinese. And so we're looking at that and trying to make sure that. So it's not just a protection from a grid standpoint, because you have a number of electric utilities that are trying to take some precautions, of what we have to do from a national security standpoint. So, thanks to you and others like you, we put that on the top 10 bucket list to try to address.
So this next question is in regard to the military. It's from Julie McGarry. He says, we are a military family, Army Ranger. What are you willing to do to help us win 15 years of back-to-back deployments?
Thank you for allowing your son or daughter, your husband, to serve. So thank you for serving, and multiple deployments is probably the thing that takes the greatest toll on military families, and yet where we've gone with that is it hasn't gotten better. And I've got a military advisory group that doesn't just have generals and admirals. It has, master sergeants, and it has, several other enlisted individuals. And what I found is they're able to highlight a number of these things, and the multiple deployments was one of those that they let me know. So I can tell you what we've done is two things. We've increased the DoD funding, but with one caveat, that we've got to make sure that we don't grow the Pentagon, that we start getting into the fighting men and women who are being deployed. Because you know what? We don't need a bigger bureaucracy at the Pentagon. In fact, I went to John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who are all about, you know, DOD spending, and I told them I would support a higher number, but I wanted to lower the number of generals that we had at the Pentagon and send it to those military men and women who are deployed so that we can stop the multiple deployments. So it's actually he agreed to that. I mean, it was interesting as we look at that, but it's also we're looking at increasing the funding over $70 billion for defense to make sure that we're there. I can tell you the number that that we've been talking about here recently is $621 billion, which is a significant increase, but it's all about trying to make sure we get some of those deployments down. Okay. Real quick follow-up. We're getting late in the evening, as long as it's a clarifying one.
It is absolutely clarifying. Okay. While the budget has been being increased for DOD,
right,
the problem is it is for programs like the F-35,
right,
which is a multi-billion dollar program where a helmet costs $1 million.
Yeah.
And if I may, I'm so sorry.
Less on that, because I'm hitting.
Okay.
This is longer than a clarifying question, I tell you what. But we're okay. No, hold on. I can tell it's passionate, so go ahead.
No, I just want to say, I think this is really important. I would like to hear you, as I'm born and raised in these mountains.
Right.
I'm from Swannanoa.
Yeah.
Just because I'm...
You're not in my district. What are you doing talking? Listen, let me just say this. So we've gone beyond clarifying, and so let me address this. All right, because here's where I am in terms of representing people. I've never asked anybody how they're registered ever. In terms of anybody who's come into my office, I don't care. And so when that comes in, I can tell you it's all about representing the people that I have, the honor and privilege of representing. The second part of that, when it gets to really the transparency part of it, one of the things that I actually just put in, and it gets back to working with Democrats, and it doesn't necessarily sit well on my side of the aisle, but the Democrats are with me on this, is all about transparency in purchasing. I think what we need to be able to do is instead of buying a $500 hammer that you go on Amazon and let them deliver it for $15, whatever the cost may be, but that we have the technology now. When we started the procurement process, it was all about getting good value for your dollar. Now we have the internet that actually should do that. So actually you'll see not only legislation that I've sponsored, but working in a bipartisan way to do that, and I appreciate your willingness to bring it forth.
Thank you.
That means a lot. Thank you. Thank you.
And this next question is in regard to the debt ceiling and fiscal responsibility. And there's two people that had very similar questions, so I'm going to read out both of their names, Jane Koenig and Susie Leonard. And basically, it's asking if you, as a meter, the chairman of the Freedom Caucus, will vote yes to raise the debt ceiling.
Okay, we have put three different parameters in it. Actually, if there's reporters here, there will be a fourth that may be newsworthy today that we are actually throwing out with regards to the debt ceiling. We believe that we need to get a hold of the fundamental problem is that far too much money is spent in Washington, D.C. In fact, I think most of us in a bipartisan manner can agree to that. Seven of the richest counties in the country are in and around Washington,
D.C.
And that's really your taxpayer dollar going up there for a lot of times special interests. And I'll be the first one to say that. So as we look at that, one of the things that we've been trying to really tackle is to not vote for a debt ceiling increase that is not accompanied with some kind of spending cut or reform that would actually bend that curve down where we start to spend more responsibly. Now, when we talk about a debt ceiling, you know, some people say, well, you've got to just increase it because you're spending the money. And that there is some truth to that. The full faith and credit of our country doesn't need to be at risk. But it's also like maxing out your credit card every single month and then calling for an increase in the amount of credit limit that you have so that you can continue to spend. At some point, you have to have some fiscal restraint. So here's one of the things that we've looked at. We said that we would actually support a debt ceiling increase if it was accompanied with some $250 billion in cuts. And 250, when you look at that, that's $250 billion over 10 years. That's the way they count in Washington, D.C. So anytime that you mention a number, it is multiplied times 10 years. And so that would be $25 billion per year. That was one area that we looked at. The other is to do some structural reforms. As we look at those structural reforms, is being able to bring those in where in the event that appropriations don't happen, is that we allow ourselves to prioritize our debt, and it's called the Schweikert Amendment. It would actually come in and allow us to make sure that we can keep parts of the government open in the event that things were not appropriated. The third thing, that's only if it's not appropriated. And so the third thing that came up is the president has put forth a regulatory executive order where he says that you only add one new regulation for every two that you get rid of. And so we have looked at attaching that to a debt ceiling as well. And so all of those are options. And so it really depends at this point. I can tell you that there are many within the administration that's wanting to do a clean debt ceiling, which means just increase the amount of money that we borrow. And at this particular point, I believe that that could pass with predominantly mostly Democrats and a few Republicans coming across, but that looks like probably the most viable option at this point.
This next question is from James Walker in Flat Rock. He says, when will we extend health coverage providers to multiple states to allow national competition?
Okay, so competition across state lines has been a big thing that obviously we believe is one of the components of driving down costs. It's not something that we can get any bipartisan support from in terms of the Affordable Care Act. That was one of the things I thought that we could do real easy, and where you said, okay, if insurance is cheaper in Iowa, and you can buy it in Iowa and still have it provided so that you could go to Mission or your doctor here, we should be able to do that. It would have the ability to start driving down prices. So I've been for that. I believe that competition across state lines is a good thing. But we also get a pushback from our insurance commissioners in all 50 states, because they want to kind of control what the insurance market is there. And I say that, that's both Democrats and Republicans that have pushed back. And so if we get that, it could potentially be part of the Obamacare repeal and replacement effort. But at this point, I don't believe it would fit in the budget tool that allows for just 51 votes on the Republican side. So it would require 8 Democrats in the Senate. And I don't see that, but that's, it's a valid thing. Should lower cost, not a great deal, only about 2% is what they say with the competition across state lines, but it certainly drives them down. Thanks.
This next question is from William Height from Asheville. It says, we hear a lot about restructuring the federal tax code. Would you please explain your position concerning reduction of corporate tax rates and closing tax loopholes?
You know, everybody's for closing tax loopholes until it comes to their tax loopholes, is what I found. And so I can tell you, I'm one that believes that we need to be a lot stronger with closing the tax loopholes and get to a very simplified system. But for me, I believe that what we do is that we actually come in and we simplify in such a way that you can fill out your tax return on a postcard. So you have a mortgage deduction, a charitable deduction, a deduction for education, and probably some safety net provision for child income tax credit. Those would be the four that have been discussed. Beyond that, in terms of the loopholes, you know, we can't continue to pick winners and losers, because every time the federal government picks winners and losers, it's a special carve out for this industry and that industry. Now, I can tell you, there are some winners and losers, though, that even Democrats want the winners and losers to be picked. And so we really have to look at some of these things in real terms. If we're all going to get together, and that's what I've told some of my colleagues, if we're going to get rid of the tax loopholes, let's get rid of all of them, let's simplify it, let's lower the corporate rate, but also just a second. I'll be glad to explain why it's good for America for us to do that. Okay, I'll be glad to do this. And so as we look at that, we lower the corporate rate, but not just for big corporations. It really needs to come through and go to honestly the small businesses that do the predominant part of employing people and making sure that they get a lower rate as well. Now, when you do that, you also need to make sure that individuals that are not part of a small business or not part of a major corporation, that they get it. So we've been for doubling the standard deduction and making sure that we put money back in everyone's pocket, which would be about $1,500 when you double that standard deduction. In doing that. But it gets back to simplifying the code. Here's the reason why we look at a corporate rate and why it's important to all of us. You know, you have this thing, what they call inversions right now, where people are actually taking their companies offshore and they're actually inverting and saying that they're a foreign company. Well, part of that is because we have one of the highest, if not the highest, corporate rates in on the globe.
That's right.
Okay. Hold on just a second. Even with the tax loopholes, the effective rate is still higher. So as we look at that, let's bring it down. And one of the reasons why I looked at, if you look at the sweet spot in terms of what they call base erosion, you know, and this is really about trying to keep American firms and other firms investing here so that there's good jobs, that sweet spot is about a 16 to 17% corporate rate. Now, that may be an effective rate, but that's 16 to 17%. Because if not, if they're going to expand, many times they make a decision to expand in a more tax-friendly environment. And with the global economy that we have, we need to make sure that we do that. So I'm all for doing that, repatriating those dollars, making a mandatory repatriation that brings them back, invest them here in the United States. I think if we do that, we get a little better than 3% GDP growth. You start to do it, you actually increase revenue over time, but it's all about getting rid of those loopholes and making sure that the tax code isn't this high, you know, that it's this high. And so it's being aggressive.
This next question is from Renee Raffini of Arden. She says, do you support either a federal law or a state law to require presidential candidates to release their tax returns?
Do you make a federal law to compel it? Well, here's the answer. The last time I checked, in the Constitution, it wasn't there. And here's what I'm going to say is there are more federal disclosure forms that you have to fill out a plethora of federal disclosure forms on every office. And so as we do that, the answer to your question is no, I wouldn't support that. I am for disclosure and oversight.
This next question is from Sam Seacrest of Mills River. He says, how is it that a plain builder developer can know what the American people want from government, but the professional politicians don't have a clue?
Careful, Mark.
Thank you for your question. Here's where we have to get back to, and I started this earlier on. It's about the forgotten man or woman. And regardless of where you are on party, whether you're a Democrat, unaffiliated, or Republican, we have to turn our government back to its rightful owner, which is we the people.
That's right.
And that's why I take the comment that was made from the friend from Swannanoa so seriously, because one of the things that I've tried my best to do is get input from people who don't necessarily agree with me. My son was a national champion debater, and I told him that there's an element of truth in every argument, and look for the element of truth. Now, sometimes that element of truth is small, and sometimes it's great, but look for the element of truth in every argument. We've got to get back to a place where people believe that their input matters, and also that what they say actually carries weight. There have been many votes that I've taken. In fact, many of you participated on online surveys on some of the major votes where we actually put them out there on Facebook. There's been times where it's been difficult because I have a personal feeling that I need to be going this way, and the numbers that are coming in are very different. I'll give you a prime example. When President Obama felt like that we needed to invade Syria and send troops to Syria, and people may not even remember that, but that was about 4 years ago. And so as he was looking at that, I felt like, knowing what I knew about on the ground, that there needed to be some type of intervention to stop it from really, from the genocide that was going on and all the horrible things that were going on. The fact that Syria wouldn't be there, in my opinion. In fact, we had a town hall here where I think I told you, ultimately what I see with Syria is that it ends up in three countries. And yet, here was what happened was, is overwhelmingly 86% of the people that contacted my office, whether it was by phone, email, or Facebook, actually said that they didn't support that. And so I had to actually take a vote and say that I wasn't in favor of that. And that was difficult because of what I had seen. So we've just got to do a better job of listening. And I can tell you, every single question that you have here that you've written tonight, every single one of those will not only get an answer, but it will get reviewed by me personally. Because what I want to do is understand, even if there are some snarky comments on there, I wouldn't think that there would be many, but even if there are some snarky comments, I want to make sure that I hear it, and that's what it is. And you know, I have the privilege and honor of serving this great 11th Congressional District. It's a temporary job. As we've already talked about, I'm fraternal with us.
Yeah.
It's a temporary job, and so in doing that, while I'm here, I want to make sure that I listen and have it and hopefully get a good response. But thank you for your question.
This next question is from Ken Fitch from Hendersonville. Although you currently have a national platform, our region has issues that differ from those elsewhere. In your view, what are the priority issues for our region that must be addressed?
Yeah, so the priority for our region, thank you for your question. The priorities for our region, I think, would still be jobs, number one. It still critically is jobs and the economy. There are some counties that are doing very well, and there are still many that are not. So it's all about making sure that jobs and the promotion of job growth is critical. The other that we haven't talked about tonight, which has been a little bit surprising because we just haven't gotten to it yet, is immigration. I can tell you I had two conversations today, and there are people on many sides of this immigration issue. So any decision I make, I'm going to have 48% of the people mad. I can just tell you, because what happens is there are people that are very passionate. I was with two farmers today that were really talking about the need for agricultural labor. And they said, you know, they've got these jobs and that fruit will fall off the tree if we don't. So we've got to address that. And in addressing that, one of the things that I believe that we start with and that may not be as well received is any immigration reform that we do has to start with secure borders.
Now, in securing those borders, it allows us to deal with the situation on a region by region basis, and also when I have a need for guest workers, it allows me to deal with that here. And so we're going to have to deal with the immigration issue. So that's a national issue, but it's also a local issue. And then the third thing is with our veterans. I talked about this earlier. We lost Ms. Brayfogel from the Veterans Hospital here. She got a promotion to go on. I think it's she's now over Kentucky and Virginia, but it's a multi-state promotion. She was just absolutely wonderful to deal with. I mean, truly, I could call her. We had somebody that got a hold of me through a friend who was having a hard time getting somebody in at midnight. I called, and within 12 minutes, that person was in and admitted, and that was the kind of dedication we saw from her. And so I'm hopeful that her replacement is that way, but it's not just there. It's about our homeless vets, and there's a ministry in Buncombe County that really deals with that. We actually introduced some legislation the other day to help with our homeless vets to make sure that we do that. And I can tell you that when we look at our veterans and making sure that we take care of them, when we look at making sure that jobs are there and dealing with immigration, hopefully all of those are three priorities. Now, there's other things that go into that, like I mentioned, broadband and infrastructure and a number of local things that support those, but those would be the three main pillars.
And the environment.
Yeah. And the environment. Mike Hill would remind me of that. Okay.
Our next question.
Did you have a clarifying? I got that up close and personal with one of the best advocates. It was her daughter. I mean, and who was real respectful and probably will never vote for me, but she was very respectful and came in and did a great job. She might if I actually follow through on something. But we'll be there.
This next question is from Fred Hofstede of Hendersonville. Since you have been in the House, can you give a few examples of what the House has done to restore any individual liberties or remove unreasonable regulations from small businesses?
There's been a number of regulations that actually have been removed recently. We put together a list of some 300 plus different regulations that actually looked to either be modified or changed, and trying to make sure that not only things are streamlined, but certainly that as we look to those regulations, that they're not costing us more than what they're benefiting us. Because what happens a lot of times on regulations is that the bureaucrats in the federal government have one job, and that's to make another rule on top of another rule on top of another rule. So let me ask you this. How many of you have actually read the Federal Register? Okay, so if you've read the Federal Register, you realize that we get a Federal Registry every single month that is very voluminous. And when we look at this, there are a number of regulations. Now, I'm all for one that believes that what we have is good regulations, and those that should be kept in place, we should. But yet at the same time, we also know that we can just write things on top of other things, and sometimes when they don't make any sense or financial impact at all. And so you've seen those, and yet I'm not one that here that says you throw them all out either. And what I want us to do is to actually have a process where we review those and we do that. And so as we look at those regulations, you know, there was a study done in 2011 that said that with every 5% reduction in regulations, you create over 1 million jobs. Now, when you look at that, Google it. I encourage you, 2011, and you do that. And so as we look at that, one of the keys is that whenever you look at streamlining the federal government, what happens is that generally you see things take off. We saw this in the early 80s as the regulations got rolled back. We saw an economy that boomed. And so I'm here to tell you that as a business guy, listen, you guys can argue all day long. As a business guy, I understand that there are regulations and there are those that you need and should comply with. But there's also a whole lot of regulations and things that you get taxed and feed on that have nothing to do with the output. And so I'm here to say that we need to take a fresh look.
This next question. The next question is from Rob Holland of Arden. He says, are the Republicans, and specifically the Freedom Caucus, preparing to shut down the government over the budget?
Yeah. All right, so the answer is no. The answer is we're not planning to shut anything down. And as we look at that, one of the keys that we have is where we go in terms of this particular budget. Now, we're about to increase the amount of money that we spend in addition to the Department of Defense dollars. We're probably going to increase the amount of money that we're spending by well over $100 billion. Now, that's not the budget that's sitting out there now, but really when you look at what's going to pass out of the House and Senate and ultimately be signed in, it will be over $100 billion increase. Now, guys, eventually, that adds up to real money. And I'm here to tell you that as we start to look at $100 billion increases, we've got to get a real grip on it. So here's one of the things that, you know, you'll find I always shoot straight with you. And so one of the things that I've been advocating with is one of the things that I believe that we need to do is that we need to put the value back in work again. And what happens is on some of the safety net programs where we have an able-bodied adult with non-dependent children, so I'm not talking about a mom, a single mom with kids or a grandparents with kids, but when we have an able-bodied adult with non-dependent children, there needs to be a work requirement for them to get the Because what happens is, as I talked to an apple farmer today, he says the biggest competition he has for people working in his packing house is actually the federal government who pays people to stay home.
That's right.
When I say that, that is a true statement.
That's right. That's right.
So for those of you that disagree with me, what would be a reasonable standard or a work requirement for somebody who is able-bodied, adult, with non-dependent children, do you think that they should be required to work 20 hours a week in order to receive benefits? All right, so here's what we're proposing. So whether you agree with that or not, is that we believe that at least 20 hours a week should be what you're doing. And that if you're able-bodied and you don't have children, that we should have a welfare program that says that we believe that you should work. Now, if it's you can't find a job, then we would qualify for vocational training, or we would qualify volunteering for a local government. Any of those would qualify. Now, you know what happened when Maine did that? 72% of the people came off the rolls. Woo! But I don't see it. I said able body. And so, able body would count for able minded as well. So, all right, as we look at that.
This next question, and it will be our last question before we turn it back over to Sheriff McDonald, is from Dave Big of Marshall. He says, thank you for having a town hall, and how much, if any, government resources would you allocate to building the wall?
Well, before I close with the answer to that question, I do want to say two things. One, thank you for being respectful and even vocal with your opposition, but being respectful in that. And I want to just say thank you. I really appreciate that. It is an encouragement. It is an encouragement to me that that we can have this kind of discourse and perhaps even disagreement and still do it in a way that really lets the third world countries know that America is different. You know, we're different. We're different. And so I want to thank you for that.
This, the second part of that is this. Many of you have written down things that actually may have been actual part of constituent services. What I would say is actually something that you need help with, whether it's Social Security or Medicare or an issue like that. We will be following up with you. We'll actually be opening a case file to do that. Some of you, like the commissioner, is actually, I saw a question back there about getting 100 acres of federal lands or something. So I didn't get to your question, but I will follow up with you. So here's where I would like to. Our staff is here for only one purpose, and that's to serve you. And I can tell you, our constituent services is envied across the congressional delegation, and really about among a number of others, because they have one thought in mind. And that is to serve you and to treat you as if you are their family when they're working. And if they ever ask you for your party affiliation, they know that that is a fireable offense. Because we don't play that. At the same time, I would say this. They are so dedicated. If you're mad at me, please take it out on me. Don't take it out on them. I do, and I see that you do agree with that. So, well, there's been about five things that we can agree on today. So I say that. I'm getting to the wall. There hasn't been a single question that I have avoided tonight, even though it would have been probably a lot easier for me to avoid. I won't do that. So here's where I am on the wall. I've actually made a public position on this. I do believe that our immigration policy, whether you're a conservative or liberal on that particular area, has to start with a secure southern border.
Yep.
So I believe that we have to build the wall. Many of you have asked about. And so we believe that there will be a wall in some areas, there will be a virtual fence in some areas, that will really be about securing our southern border. And then as we work through an immigration process that makes sure that not only that we have the guest workers that we actually need, but also that we have really a country that we understand we can work on a legal immigration system that actually works for us, because we're all a nation of immigrants. But we also have to understand, and without sharing anything classified, there is a whole lot of bad things that are coming across our southern border that have nothing to do with those that may be in our community. And I'm here to tell you that we have to address that. So let me close by saying, I appreciate you coming out. I appreciate. That cost is all kinds of estimates. I believe that honestly, that if there's any amount of monies that's allocated to it this year, would probably be a little over $2 million. Which honestly doesn't build a wall. It doesn't build a wall. I mean, it's a $12 to $20 billion fee, but as we look at that. And so as we look at that, Well, Mexico, I don't think is paying for it. So as we look at it, here's what I would like to say. Please continue to contact our office. Please continue to send us emails and let us know how you think. And when you see an online survey on a major piece of legislation, even though you may have contacted us via email, please make sure that you go on and fill those surveys out, because we track those now. If you're not in my district, it won't let you do it. But if you're in my district, it will allow you to do that. And so thank you. God bless you. I appreciate y'all coming out tonight.